All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the next edition of our monthly speaker series with the Fiji Wealth Management Team down in Clearwater. This is John Fiji Jr., and I'm accompanied, as always, with our senior member of our team and senior portfolio manager, John Patika Sr. We've got a special guest today. He's been on the call a couple of different times in the past. His name is Jay Dobson, and he's been with UBS and our chief investment office since 2016, but has way over 30 years of investment experience, primarily in as a equity research analyst for utilities and the energy sector. I mean, covering pipelines, independents, power producers, infrastructure, downstream, upstream. Jay was a former member of the Department of Energy Electricity Advisory Board to the U.S. Energy Secretary. So welcome, Jay, to our call this morning.
Yeah, no, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. It's great to be back. And as always, look forward to talking a bit about the energy landscape.
Thanks, Jay. Well, we'll get right to it. Jay, between the, you know, the AI with the big data centers and the electric cars and the cryptocurrency mining, general growth around the world, in fact, I'm going to ask you, we're going to talk about where do we get all this new electric? Where do we get all this energy? And most of all, how do we make money doing it? How do my clients invest in this to make money? So I'm just going to let you get started with that, and then we'll go on and talk some more.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And allow me to step back and frame it a little bit, because I really do think this is a really big shift since the last time we spoke. You know, we've been watching energy demand growth, and you know, we call it sort of all energy demand, but electricity would be in there. That's another form of, you know, sort of generated energy. But really, it's been a function of GDP growth. And that is actually through efficiency been, you know, getting sort of lower as a function of GDP. And we've been sort of expecting the energy transition to occur, understanding that, you know, energy demand growth was sort of slow. What's different in the last year, and you just mentioned it, you know, AI, data centers, reshoring of industrial activity, and then, of course, something that's been going on in the background for a while, electrification, all is driving energy demand higher. You know, when we just talk about AI and data centers here in the United States, those two alone have the potential to, you know, move energy demand, electricity demand in this case, you know, to levels we haven't seen since the 1950s or 1960s here in the United States. So it's a big deal. And you ask the right question. Well, two right questions. A, how are we going to supply this? And B, how do we make money at it? You know, the reality is electricity and energy are really just normal commodity markets. They operate on a very specific principle of supply and demand. So when we have, you know, short supply or even fixed supply and rising demand, you know, we tend to get a pretty good environment for suppliers. And obviously just the opposite. When we have slagging demand and, you know, sort of fixed supply, that tends to work in favor of consumers. So where we are right now is a pretty tight environment. We can go sort of class by class, but, you know, oil, we probably are okay on supply, but, you know, really look out 5 years and that could be different, tighter. Natural gas, we've got a good amount of it, but same thing, we probably only have to look out a year or two and we probably get to a tighter market. In electricity here in the United States, it's already pretty tight. And unlike oil and natural gas, it's pretty hard to build new supply. So there's a lot of environmental regulations one has to go through. So I would say right now, we like the entire energy landscape. But I would say the one that seems most timely is some of the electricity guys, but as well, some of the energy, you know, so, you know, the oil and gas companies, I would say, are some of the names. We just put a couple of those on our top picks list, sort of anticipating that seasonally, we're going to see a little higher demand. But, you know, really, you're talking about the longer term demand. And yeah, I think there's a big opportunity here as a result of, again, AI, data centers, and industrial reshoring to drive energy company equities higher.
Jay, before we go any further, how about explaining the difference between regulated utilities and non-regulated? It's a thing that needs to be understood, I think, if we're to make money.
Yeah, no, great point. And I'm glad you raised that since I was just talking about electricity. So the electricity markets here in the United States, you know, they use, you know, nuclear, natural gas, coal as, you know, ways to generate electricity. And if you go back, oh God, now it's got to be sort of 40 years. It started in the 1980s and really took charge in the 90s in California. But there was a wave of, you know, sort of deregulation. Why do we have electricity facilities regulated? We should let competition, you know, sort of take its toll. And, you know, most of that was really as a result of excess capacity. It lulled policymakers into believing, well, you know, if we deregulate in an excess supply environment, well, prices will go down and consumers will benefit. Again, as I mentioned earlier, you have to keep in mind it's really hard to build, you know, electric generating facilities, environmental rules, policy rules, et cetera. So, you know, we've seen about one third of the electric generating facilities in the United States deregulated. The wires, of course, remain 100% regulated. Well, about 99% regulated, but that's a footnote for a different conversation. But the wires are regulated. It's the generation that isn't. And what you're seeing here is when supply gets tight and demand is rising, you know, you're seeing companies, you know, scramble for supply. And one way that big companies can do that is by, you know, going directly to suppliers. So when we talk about the less regulated or really unregulated utilities, these are companies that only generate electricity, and they do so with, you know, I wouldn't say unregulated fully. They are regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, but don't have state-regulated price regulation, which is what, you know, generally the regulated utilities have. So, you know, like in places like Texas, they'll get a market price, quote unquote, for the power they sell. And that obviously, particularly in Texas, but anywhere, varies with the level of demand. If you get a big hot weather day in Texas, you know, you'll be selling power for a pretty attractive price relative to your costs. But I would point out in the utility index, you know, most of these companies are regulated. There's probably four or five of them. They're pretty large that are unregulated, but most of them remain regulated. So hopefully that helps you understand the difference between the regulated and unregulated utilities.
Well, it does. And we'll talk about that as we go forward. It seems that big data centers need something that doesn't get interrupted, and they're trying to build around some of these old nuclear plants and so forth. But we'll get into that. What I want to do now, though, is to talk about the sources of energy. If you talk maybe first about the hydrocarbons.
When we talk about, and this is sort of on the energy transition discussion, but, you know, I would say, you know, people get hung up on, you know, sort of where is our energy, you know, going to come from in the future. And I always want to ground people in, like, let's focus on, you know, where it's coming from right now, and that'll begin to unfold the story of where it's going. And, you know, the reality is, you know, people may like or dislike this, but this is the reality. About 81% of global energy supplies, varies by region, but when looking at the globe as a total, 81% come from fossil fuels. So look, the reality is it's going to be hard to change that. You know, we have a chart that we use that we've put together in conjunction with some companies, but, you know, we look at, you know, global energy supplies going all the way back to the early 1800s, and obviously wood, and then oil and coal, and then natural gas, and you build up, and obviously it's a bit of an exponential growth in energy demand, but you see where all the supplies are coming from. And, you know, look, wind and solar and nuclear have come on in the recent past, quote unquote, let's call it the last 50 or so years. But, you know, reality is, you know, those are still relatively small pieces of the total supply pie. So I think those, you know, lower carbon alternatives are going to be really fast growing, but the idea that they're going to fully displace this, in something short of a century, I think it's going to be awfully hard to pull off.
Interesting. How about next, let's talk about nuclear sourcing for energy.
Yeah, I've been a fan of nuclear for a very long time. I think it is a really, really exciting technology. We do it at utility scale primarily around the world. And what that means is think of the biggest industrial facility you can think of, and that's a nuclear plant. You know, we've got a lot of them in France, here in the U.S., China, India, are doing a number of them. They are big facilities, very expensive to build, but what we found is they last an awfully long time. You know, a number of these facilities, you know, are depreciated for accounting purposes over like 30 or 35 years, but we're finding here in the U.S., where I would argue we're probably the best nuclear operators in the world, we're finding we can safely operate these for 60 or 80 years. So it's really exciting. And recall, these are very, very low carbon alternatives. And I'm talking life cycle operating. They're zero carbon emissions, but very exciting. And I think it's important just to say out loud, because I think this is a bit of a misnomer, you know, nuclear is a really, really safe technology. Really heavily regulated, but very, very safe. The other thing that I think is interesting is, you know, these are primarily fission reactors, but we can talk about nuclear fusion, which is, you know, sort of 20 years out. Some people might disagree with that, but there's a lot of research going on that. But in the interim, I think there's also these small modular reactors, which would be much smaller than these large industrial facilities I'm talking about, and would be manufactured in an industrial complex. So you'd be stamping them out a little bit like you produce cars, and they would be self-contained, just dropped on site and operated. People like Bill Gates and other people are, you know, really standing, U.S. government actually too, standing behind these technologies and saying, you know, these could be, you know, real game changers. You probably don't see them commercially available until the early 1930s. Golly, I'm showing my age. The early 2030s. But the reality is, it's a pretty exciting technology that I get pretty excited about. There's not a great way to invest in it right now, but it's an area we watch really carefully. But I'd say nuclear, we could have a podcast just on nuclear. There's a lot of exciting stuff going on there. It takes a long time, so it's not going to be the fast change area of energy supply. But, you know, after wind and solar, I think nuclear is one of the more exciting areas to watch over the next two decades.
How long until fusion? You know, you see some of these reports, they act as if it's pretty much around the corner. I don't think that's the truth. But what are your comments?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, I don't think it's around the corner. Lots of people are putting a lot of effort behind this. I mean, keep in mind what they're studying in nuclear fusion is basically the way our sun in our solar system produces power. And it's exciting technology. It's just never, ever been gotten to work at scale. So lots of work still going into that. I would say realistically, we're a decade away. But the only thing I say, every one of the comments here is about AI, not because of the goofy things and how it can generate pictures on the internet, do some of that stuff. You know, the real ways companies and researchers are putting this to work, because it can iterate much faster than a human mind can. And I think a number of things in the chemicals business, as well as in some of these R and research and development businesses, AI is going to be a real game changer and could. I don't think it's this year, next year, but if we say over the next 5 years, it's pretty exciting about what it can do to some of these research and development projects. So stay tuned. I'll stick with it's 10 years out, but, you know, I'd be happy to report in our next podcast, maybe to say, hey, it's now only 7 years away. And hopefully we'll have these calls more frequently than once a year. So I can, you know, not be actually just saying 1 year has passed, but actually saying things are moving faster as a matter of AI and some of the R&D that's going into nuclear fusion and other technologies.
We'll take you up on that, Jay. How about just quick comments on hydrogen, you know, green hydrogen, gray hydrogen, all confusing to me. Is that progressing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably slowed a little bit. You know, the common misconception is that hydrogen's new. We produce a good amount of hydrogen. It comes from the natural gas stream right now. And the problem is you produce a lot of carbon dioxide in the production of hydrogen. That's the gray hydrogen that you mentioned a moment ago. You know, what we have talked about, I guess because people like colors, is blue and green hydrogen. You know, in blue hydrogen, you capture the carbon dioxide that's produced through a carbon capture and sequestration process. And that is still more expensive, but potentially economic. And then there's green hydrogen where, you know, pretty exciting, but what you're doing instead of taking it out of the natural gas stream, you're using an electrolyzer powered by solar primarily. And that electrolyzer is taking water in. Water, as we all know from our high school chemistry, is hydrogen H2O, and we're separating those two hydrogen atoms from the single oxygen atom and making, you know, an oxygen stream and a hydrogen stream. That's really expensive right now. So, you know, we'll have to see how that develops. But hydrogen's exciting. I think it plays a role, but it's out there sort of in the nuclear fusion from either the blue or the green version of hydrogen and sort of expand its role in the global energy supply regime.
Last one on this theme, wind and solar on the utility side, how's that working out?
Yeah, these are really inexpensive technologies and they continue to get cheaper. We've seen, you know, a little bit of supply chain issues since the pandemic. So I'd say it hasn't happened every year. You had a really nice, smooth, declining cost curve, you know, over the last 10 years right up to the pandemic. But these are great technologies and they are workhorses. I think the only problem, or not problem, really misconception by some people is that like wind and solar are the answer and all we need is batteries and we're good. And I just caution, it's hard to say that that would be the answer. I think we've got to have nuclear in that mix. Wind and solar will play a big role. What's exciting is adding them right now. You know, wind and solar are low teens amount of our energy supply. And when you mix it all together, you got a lot of opportunity to add a lot of wind and solar, understanding that things like natural gas and even in some regions, coal back that up because wind and solar only produce power when the wind blows and or the sun shines. And obviously, as we know, I'm standing here in New York, beautiful sunny day today, but it's not always like this. So, you know, we have to be prepared for other alternative sources when that wind isn't blowing or that sun isn't shining. But very fast-growing technologies.
I don't want to put you on a spot, but you and I in the past have talked about Europe, how they screwed it up and now they're using more coal, at least they did last year, because they shut down the nuclear in a knee-jerk reaction. Just touch on that a little bit. What's going on over Europe? There's more people than there are here.
Hey, John, it's a great point because I think the real lens I'd want people to look through, though I'm happy to say that Europe made some mistakes, so did the U.S. I think the way I'd want to frame it is Europe got overly focused on decarbonization. And I really think when you look at energy supply, you really need to think of a three-legged stool. And like any three-legged stool, any one of these legs get pulled out, the stool falls over and we have problems. And the three legs of that stool are reliability, affordability, and decarbonization. And just for clarity, affordability doesn't necessarily mean cheap. It means that it's not a regressive weight on top of the economy, because that is exactly the example you're using. When Russia invaded Ukraine and we saw zero natural gas supplies from Russia into Europe, you know, because energy is so important, I term it as the lifeblood of the global economy, we saw that continent lighting an enormous amount of coal on fire. In fact, in 2022, Europe and globally, we burned more coal than we had since 2012 or so. So, you know, the reality is people understand energy is important, needs to be reliable. Energy needs to be affordable. Again, not cheap, but, you know, within the context of our ability to, you know, sort of maintain, you know, sort of the growth in our economy and the conveniences in our life. And then also decarbonize. And I think we can do all three. People always say like, well, but those are competing. They're not competing alternatives. Yeah, it makes the calculus harder. You know, it'd be very easy to just say, let's just take the most expensive alternative and fix decarbonization. But we know that won't work. Same thing with reliability. So looking at all three of those is the lens I'd have you go through. And I think that's useful when you get into political or other discussions with, you know, your neighbors or your friends. You know, that is the way, because I think it's the great equalizer. It really does put it in perspective for folks.
Thanks. OPEC's having a meeting next week. Any thoughts on that? Any big news going to come out of there?
Yeah, I mean, OPEC is always interesting to watch. You know, oil is a big part of the global economy. They'll be having a virtual meeting on Sunday. I think odds favor them extending the existing production cuts. The only thing I worry about is that's what everybody thinks. And whenever I've been doing this long enough, 35 years or so, whenever I think like everybody else thinks, I figure, boy, the odds of us being wrong are probably high. So, you know, I still think the odds favor, let's say it's a 70 or 80% chance that they're going to roll these production cuts over. They've got about 2 million barrels that they're holding back because demand has been a little weaker in Europe and China than we expected. But I think if anything, they could cut supply ever so slightly. But I would say by and large, it'll either be boring or slightly exciting, but probably not all that exciting at the end of the day. I think that's sort of how I would characterize the OPEC meeting that's coming up here on Sunday.
Well, let's move from transition to transmission.
How about the grid?
Talk about the grid now.
Yeah, that's an exciting area. I mean, you know, we all need only look around our neighborhoods, and it's easy to see a distribution or transmission wire in our neighborhood. And this is the way that electricity gets moved around. We can broaden that, you know, definition of transmission to include, you know, gas transmission. There's actually hydrogen and ammonia transmission lines around the country, but it's really the transportation network that makes, you know, the energy, as I said, sort of the lifeblood of the global economy. Transmission is what takes it from its supply to its demand. And so it's a really important element. I would say transmission broadly, as I defined it, is really the dirty underbelly of the energy transition, simply because people don't like these things in their neighborhood. We affectionately call it NIMBY in the industry, but that's just an acronym for not in my backyard. And it's a fact. You know, everybody, whenever you talk to people, like, yes, no, we definitely want more solar, and yes, we want more transmission. It's really important to decarbonize, but don't put it in my neighborhood. You know, I have a house out on the eastern end of Long Island, beautiful, beautiful area by the beach. And they were building an offshore wind facility. And it had obviously had to land onto the beach and go inland to a substation. And you wouldn't believe the outrage of people who didn't want, you know, temporarily the street to be dug up and a transmission line to be buried to bring this offshore, very clean and low cost power onto land. And so it just shows you, it was the best example I have recently of where you have all these great things, but the local people really don't like disruption around it. So, you know, there's a lot of ways the technology is looking at maybe putting more sort of load on existing transmission wires and in existing pipelines without risk. But those are technologies, again, back to the AI example, and maybe we can get some breakthroughs to see how we can do that. But at the end of the day, we probably need to build more transmission lines, transmission pipes, and we probably need the federal government to pass some siting legislation that makes this a little bit easier, because it's really hard. It takes multiple years. In fact, a transmission line got built by a Midwest utility just recently, and they finished building it after 17 years of permitting and construction. That's insane.
Oh, yeah, you can't wait 17 years already. Jay, we talked before about using the federal highway system, bury some transmission. Is there any hope or any talk about that to move energy around?
It's possible. I would think of that as being like a last resort. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I think you've got existing right of ways where we probably can increase the edges of them. But I do think I don't want to rule out any possibility, because I do think this is something, you know, I think Tip O'Neill once said, all politics are local. And I think that's what it is. So you really need to say, hey, here's all the options, highways, expanded right-of-ways, et cetera, and really put out a menu of options that then can locally be dealt with. And each state or even county can decide, hey, this is how we want to do it. Like all things, it's going to be sort of how those, you know, seams issues work out, where one state meets the next, where one county meets the next. That's always where it's most interesting, because if one county wants to approach it, or state wants to approach it one way, and the neighboring state or county wants to do it a different way, obviously those are the disputes that need to be worked out. But it's an interesting alternative, and one that certainly should be in the mix.
Will this election have, depending on who wins and the makeup of Congress and all those complicated things, but does it have the potential to be a game changer anywhere?
I wouldn't say necessarily a game changer, but it'll have an impact. Now, the first thing I want to point out is I think the biggest impact, and this is a sad commentary on where we are politically and societally, but I think the rhetoric will be massively different. And that's not a comment on either candidate. It's just, you know, Republicans have one way of talking about energy and energy transition, and Democrats are different. I think when you really get inside the policies, there's probably less difference. I mean, when you look at U.S. oil production, you know, U.S. oil production grew 8% last year, which is one of the fastest years since the pandemic. So, you know, you're seeing rapid oil production growth here in the U.S. It's slowing this year, but I'd say policies have been in place to allow that to occur. I think where you probably would see the biggest potential movement would be around this electricity side, and potentially some changes in, you know, sort of tax benefits for some of the energy transition and transition elements that came out of recent legislation. But I'd say outside of that, probably not much. And mostly, again, when you're inside, I mean, even when you think about like the LNG pause that we have going on, and you talk to people at the Department of Energy, they say, hey, we won't really be talking about that this time next year. And obviously they anticipate being reelected as Democrats. So even have Democrats privately saying, you know, different things than they're said out loud. And I think Republicans are in the same. So I think rhetoric, radically different. At the policy level, a little different. You know, you'd see EPA act differently. You'd see DOE acting differently, but policy sort of at the margin, a little different.
All right, Jay. So the stock market's moved up quite a bit. You've written several pieces on all of this. And so let's get to it. How we make money. I know we have to be careful with the compliance department by naming individual stocks. But let's talk sectors. How do we do this?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, as you pointed out, I am responsible for utilities, all things energy, all things transportation of energy. And when I look across those sectors, you know, we've got a neutral view of utilities, but I think there's some exciting elements there, as we wrote recently in our U.S. utilities equity preference list, or EPL, as we affectionately call it. We like the independent power producers. Those are the unregulated guys that we mentioned a little while ago. We also like, you know, some of the utilities that are really rapidly developing in wind and solar. So those are definitely some in the electric utility and the independent power producer subsectors. But definitely, if you want specific names, you know, reach out to your FA and definitely get the U.S. utilities equity preference list. The energy equity preference list, U.S. energy equity preference list, or EPL. We like the exploration and production companies. We like the integrated oils, and we like the refiners. And same thing in that equity preference list report. We've got a number of our most preferred ideas. We also have a top picks list. I'm part of the chief investment office that serves the wealth management group of UBS. But I have 10 awesome colleagues on our U.S. equity team. We once a month publish a top picks list. And that top picks list names the one or two or three in each sector that we think are most timely. And that's another report I'd encourage you to take a look at, only because it's just a nice sort of, you know, once a month post on what the most timely ideas that each of my equity colleagues across the various industries, you know, information technologies, financials, healthcare, you know, what stocks we like there. So I'd say those are really, really good reports. The only other one I'd highlight, and it's not so much an equities, but you know, so much of my world is tied up in the commodity markets. I work really closely with my colleague Giovanni Stanovo, who's in the Chief Investment Office of UBS over in Zurich, but he is really well plugged in the commodities world. Oil, natural gas, coal, all of these. He does the metals as well, but really well plugged in. He actually has a couple of contacts in the Saudi Arabian government that helps him get a pretty good click of what's happening. He helps me form my judgments around things like OPEC meetings and otherwise. And so I would say some of the you know, global commodity reports are definitely worth a look if you're interested. Again, there's not a lot to do there, though. You know, we do definitely like oil at these levels, but that's another one where I think there's some good insights that you can get out of it. But a bunch of reports are available, John. So hopefully those are helpful.
Great, Jay. It's John Jr. here. Yeah, if anyone would like any of those reports, feel free to reach out to our team. We'll send them out to you. And Jay, we getting towards the end of our call here. And as we wrap up, I just want to see if you had any final thoughts here before we close out this call.
Yeah, I mean, we've covered a lot of landscape here. I mean, I think the couple things I'd really point out, and they'd only be reiterating things that I said, is really this idea of an all of the above transition, because I think that all of the above transition really is a good way to look at, you know, equity exposure in energy. Some people get very excited about renewables, but I would be loath for somebody to say all of my energy exposure in my equity portfolio is in renewables. You know, you really need to have all of the above. So you want to have exposure in renewables in your equities. You want to have oil and gas. You want to have electricity. You want to have all of those, because again, supply and demand, it's going to make some of those work differently and better at various points in the energy transition. And then again, the other point I'd make is again, that three-legged stool: reliability, affordability, and decarbonization. You know, use that as sort of your North Star, and it will help you get to a lot of the answers, I think, appropriately as to what to do with your equity portfolio and actually how to talk to your friends and neighbors about the energy transition.
Great. Well, Jay, that was a really interesting discussion. We really appreciate you spending time with us today. For anyone listening to this call, you know, you'll be able to a replay of this will be on our podcast channel on the Pasika Wealth Management podcast channel on Apple that you can get. Also on our website. Once again, Jay, thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning to talk a little bit about the energy sector, because this really is interesting, you know, what's going on, especially with this election coming in and the future of our electric grid.
Yeah, John, James, thank you so much. Really appreciate the time. And everyone listening, definitely look forward to speaking again on this interesting topic.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you. All right. Okay, and that concludes our call, everyone. You have a great day.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.